This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. House Speaker Robert DeLeo has made legalizing gambling in Massachusetts one of his priorities since he joined the legislature close to 20 years ago. But DeLeo now says gambling will drop to the bottom of his legislative agenda next session. In comments to the Boston Globe, DeLeo said interest in expanded gaming in the state has declined since gambling legislation failed to pass earlier this year. So is it all over for casinos in Massachusetts? We'll ask our Week in Review panel. And this week they are Renee Loth. She's a columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Renee.
Hi.
And also Ken Cooper, an independent journalist who's written for The Globe, The Washington Post, and other newspapers. Welcome back to you too, Ken.
Good to be here, Sasha.
And listeners, we're taking calls. We want to know what story caught your attention this week. We wonder if you were surprised that Speaker DeLeo seemed to be abandoning casinos or seems to be abandoning them. We wonder if you worry about the possible loss of earmarked funds for the state. That was an interesting front page story in The Globe today. Or if you think Congressman Mike Capuano's call for Nancy Pelosi to step down was just pragmatic politics, or whether you thought that was a betrayal, considering that he's been one of her confidants for quite a long time. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Renee Loth and Ken Cooper, after Governor Patrick was reelected this month, he said that he would not be proposing new gaming legislation. Now we hear Speaker DeLeo say that he's also planning to drop gambling way down his agenda. This was an issue that just dominated the headlines for so long. Do the two of you really believe that it's just going to vanish just like that? Is it truly over for Massachusetts? Renee, you want to start?
Well, you know, I'm not sure whether it's over for Massachusetts, but it's kind of an interesting, the whole saga is kind of an interesting metaphor about gambling. You know, I think the governor discovered that it's very difficult to control gambling in terms of legislation, also in terms of those who gamble. You know, the state becomes addicted to the revenue that gambling provides, and it gets very, very difficult to control the agenda. He tried to support only one or two casino complexes that would be more like destination resorts. He found that was very difficult. And as soon as the door was open to gambling, all these other interests rushed in, lots of money, lots of lobbying, and it became very difficult to control. And I think he's relieved, frankly, if we can push this way down to the bottom of the agenda.
Ken Cooper, before you weigh in on this, I want to add another part to that question, because Renee Loth just mentioned, you know, the state can become addicted to gambling revenue. Both DeLeo and Patrick have said we really need to focus on closing the budget gap. But couldn't casinos help in part close that budget gap? So why couldn't they still be part of this new effort to try to take care of the budget situation in Massachusetts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the deadlock, and I think it's that, and it may or may not last forever, is unfortunate for the Commonwealth because it's in need of economic stimulus. That said, we're talking about casino legislation here. Not necessarily the fate of casinos in the Commonwealth, because the Mashpee Wampanoags, with their federal recognition, have the authority to proceed with a casino. The question is whether they do it with or without state regulation. And Renee, as far as addiction, I guess the state is already addicted to that state lottery money, huh?
That's right. You know, I think it's important in looking at the gambling issue. I mean, there are so many facets to it, but it's important to see the difference between revenue and economic development. You know, it is a plan to bring more revenue into the state that's now possibly going out to Connecticut or other places that have gambling. It's, you know, discretionary income that people like to spend or lose on gambling. But as an economic development strategy, it's really not very useful. And there have been plenty of experience in other states that have shown how it cannibalizes other businesses and is not really that useful as an economic development policy.
One of the things that Governor Patrick said in explaining why he had to put gambling to the side was, I think his words were, it just takes all the air out of Beacon Hill. It starts to consume everything else. Why does it do that? Why can't we discuss job creation and closing the budget and gambling? Or why does it have that all-consuming effect that prevents other progress from being made?
Well, the speaker's absorption with trying to get gambling legalized for so long could have a lot to do with, at least in the House of Representatives. But and others may feel, and obviously the people spending that lobbying money feel, that they have a lot at stake. And I think Renee is right about the limited benefits in terms of economic development, but certainly new jobs would be created at a time where lots of people are looking for jobs.
Yeah. You know, and it's an issue that everybody can relate to. People, you know, most people have done a little gambling, you know, in their lives. They seem to, you know, have a personal relationship with gambling. And, you know, I think it's just it's a lot easier to debate and you know, jawbone about gambling than it is to talk about so many of the other more complicated and difficult problems that are facing the state.
In another issue, I mentioned that the Globe had a page one story today about earmarks, and many of the incoming Republicans in Congress say they want to do away with earmarks. The Globe tallied that if they did that, about $200 million would stop coming into Massachusetts. This ranges from the new Edward M. Kennedy Institute for the U.S. Senate at the JFK Museum, a science building at UMass Amherst, the new visitor center at the Paul Revere House in the North End. All of these things could be in jeopardy. So do the two of you look at this as, if earmarks were to stop, is this very bad news for Massachusetts, considering we're already looking at what we believe is a $2 billion budget deficit?
Yeah, I think it's bad news, but as much as popular as it is, and it's a good political slogan, no earmarks, it may not be wise government policy from the point of view of taxpayers. One of those good government, you know, Taxpayers United groups should do a tallying of how much money the government would waste that it's already spent on uncompleted projects. That would be a total complete waste. So this kind of blunt policy is not very wise fiscally for the federal government.
And Renee Loth, earmark has become a dirty word for many people, but there are times when they're quite legitimate.
Well, yeah. You know, let's first establish that all of the earmarks in all of the states represent less than 1% of the federal budget. Okay, it's not a huge amount of money. It is something that people can latch on to. It's easy, again, easy to understand. It's an easy issue. But, you know, it's one man's pork is another man's economic development project, you know. And so it's very difficult to say that, you know, this is useful expenditure of money and this is not. Without earmarks, it's not like these projects would go away. They would just be, you know, people would apply for, members of Congress would apply for them through the government bureaucracy instead of through Congress. It might be less transparent. It's difficult to know that it would be that much of an improvement.
I mentioned that the new visitor center at the Paul Revere House in the North End is one of the projects that could be jeopardized. And we talked today to the executive director there, a woman named Nina Zaneri. She says that the federal money would be helpful, but she also had this to say.
The federal dollars that we were looking for via earmark is 10%. And in this case, if we don't get it, it means that we have to find that someplace else. And it will take us a little bit longer and it'll be a little bit harder, but we'll get it done. It has to be done, so we will get it done.
So she's saying it's not make or break. I mean, no one would like to lose the money, but it sounds like these projects could go on.
Well, some of them certainly could, but I think others that, you know, if, for example, the Kennedy Institute, and I don't know exactly how far they're along, but if they don't get the funds to complete the building, then they've wasted money on planning and architects and, you know, maybe even, you know, some consultations with construction companies. So certainly money would be wasted by ending all earmarks right now, as opposed to future earmarks.
In the Globe story today, I believe it was Steve Lynch, the Democrat from Southie, who specifically mentioned that hospitals and medical research could really be hit by this. Are there other areas that you think actually would be very jeopardized?
Yeah, I wouldn't overstate the impact on hospital and medical research, because most of that comes through NIH, through peer-reviewed competitions now. I mean, there may be things around the edges that finance other things, but the bulk of that money that comes to Massachusetts comes through NIH in a peer review process and is not earmarked.
Yeah. My understanding is that most of the earmarks go for small nonprofit projects. In fact, I'm pretty sure that the House already has banned earmarks for for-profit companies. And so most of the earmarks are now going to nonprofit operations like the Paul Revere House.
Mm. One of the earmarks also threatened is a $1 million request for a new commuter ferry boat. It would just be added to the fleet that Massachusetts now has. This request was by Congressman Mike Capuano, and he's been in the news, of course, for another reason this week, which is that earlier this week he had called on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to step down and let somebody else take the minority leadership role in the next Congress. This is despite Capuano having been very, very close to her over the years. The day after the election, I spoke with him on this show, and here's what he said to me about Speaker Pelosi.
You know, I was friendly with the speaker because I thought she was a good speaker, a good person, and we saw eye to eye on most philosophical issues. But I get along with Steny Hoyer, I get along with Jim Clyburn, and get along very well with John Lawson and Javier Becerra. And I think, again, that's the measure of being a good inside politician. I know that's not necessarily a good thing to be in some people's books today. But nonetheless, it helps the constituents that I represent for me to be able to negotiate inside better than most.
Is there any expectation that Nancy Pelosi could retire from Congress before she serves out her term?
I don't know. I haven't asked her that, nor would I. I think she's earned the time to think about what her future is on her own.
Now, Capuano, some people think that this really is a betrayal. Some people look at it that strongly. I mean, he certainly seemed to be distancing himself from her. But I wonder if the two of you look at it that way or just as really, it's just pragmatic politics. There's been a shift in power. He needs to reshift his alliances. Renee, what do you think?
Well, you know, a lot of people expect that Congressman Capuano will be running for the U.S. Senate seat that's occupied by Senator Brown right now, Scott Brown, in a couple of years. So that campaign starts today, really. You know, Nancy Pelosi has just been made into a pariah by the Republican Party, and I think he just has decided to take his distance. You know, there are those in the party who feel like, you know, not only is that a personal betrayal, perhaps, but it's also allowing the Republican Party to, you know, to choose the Democrats' leaders. And, you know, a lot of people I've heard from other Democrats who just think, you know, why should we let them do that? We're sticking with Nancy. You know, she's our gal. But I think that you know, Capuano is just seeing the handwriting on the wall and doesn't want to be associated with her for his future political ambitions.
Ken Cooper, do you see it that way, also as a setup for a run against Scott Brown?
Yeah, it's a reflection of Capuano's Senate ambitions and pretty much nothing else. He probably figures if Pelosi does get the minority leader job in the House, that he's in the Senate, so he won't have to suffer any payback for that. It happens all the time in politics. He's kind of inside shifting of alliances, as Renee said, and it's pretty ordinary.
You know, there's also a downside risk, though, for Capuano, which I'm sure he's also considering, which is that, you know, the voters don't like disloyalty, as Paul Lascoco found out in this most recent gubernatorial campaign. So, you know, I think it's a delicate balance for Capuano.
And, of course, he did say that if no one came forward to try to replace her, he would still vote for her. So, you know, hedging his bets, I guess.
He's with her even though he's against her, before he was against her.
You know, every Friday, as the two of you know, every Friday, we talk about our hubbub of the week. This is what we call that one story that may not have gotten a lot of attention, but you think is worth calling attention to. Ken Cooper, do you want to start with yours?
Yes. Former State Senator Bill Owens and some others are discussing beginning an initiative to reinstate the elected school committee in Boston. Their feeling is that mayoral control, which started under Mayor Flynn and has continued under Mayor Menino, hasn't improved the schools as much as they want to, and they think the school system would be more responsive if, in fact, it had an elected school committee instead of the appointed body that Mayor Menino's basically appoints.
Do you think that's a good idea or not a good idea?
Quite frankly, I think who actually controls the school system isn't as important. Who manages the school system isn't important as who's managing the classrooms. It's really about teachers.
Yeah.
And I think the idea that, you know, shifting control to the mayor here or any other place that's been done was going to fix schools because the mayor was in charge. I thought it was always an illusion.
Ken Cooper, thanks for that. And Renee Loth, your hubbub of the week.
Well, you know, the new $500 million wing of the Museum of Fine Arts is a really interesting example of how nonprofits in this city can shape city building, shape the physical and cultural future of the city, especially in a down economy when very few things are being developed. New private commercial developments are going forward. Nonprofits, especially universities, but also cultural institutions like the museum, can really have a role in shaping the city.
You mean physically, in terms of what we see on the street?
Because
it's a very striking new.
That's right. Many universities also are the only things around these days that are expanding, and they bring in interesting architects, and they really have a role in shaping the look of the city.
And that's an interesting case where, because of the new doors that have opened over near the Fenway, it's actually taken an area that used to be kind of a little, made people nervous to walk through, and made it sort of a revived new area.
That's right.
I want to mention this little story that happened in the town of Bellows Falls, Vermont. This stood out to me because I was there a few years ago to do a little tiny travel story. There was a black man walking through town, wanted a haircut, walked in the barber shop, and there was a guy playing backgammon. He said, "Is the barber in?" The guy said, "No, the barber's not in." Black Eye walks by later and sees the same man who said the barber wasn't in cutting someone's hair. The man who was denied a haircut wrote a letter to the editor and basically said, I think this was racial. Now, the barber says he just does. He thinks it's very difficult to cut black people's hair, and that's why he declined to do it. And I actually wasn't sure what to make of the story. It seemed like a sad little commentary, and it was interesting because there was a little mini protest about 2 dozen protesters. But I thought that was... Did either of you see the story this week?
I didn't see it, but, you know, I think the barber would have been better served if he said, hey, look, I'll cut your hair, but I don't really know what I'm doing, if that's well, in fact the case, if that's in fact the case.
Well, he did
and
say
there are differences in how black men's hair is cut because of its texture and, you know, different things.
And he did say it's hard to do, and I just didn't want to give somebody a bad haircut. Yeah. So
well, he should have offered it with no refund.
Yeah, that would have been the better way.
It's not hard if you know what you're doing.
Ken Cooper and Renee Loth, thank you very much for coming in. Renee Loth is a columnist for the Boston Globe, and Ken Cooper is an independent journalist who's written for the Globe and the Washington Post and other papers. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.